I got to tell you also that right after that, he asked me who was bringing him back to the airport.
My name's Bob Darrell, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm a member in good standing of the Connect the Dots group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Las Vegas, Nevada. And I have been free of alcohol and all mind or emotion-altering substances since Halloween 1978. And for that, I owe you my freedom in life. I am delighted to be here today. I'm excited. One of the reasons I'm excited is after I'm done, Mildred is going to come up here and talk about fear and sex, which have been the pillars of most of my relationships. Thursday night, we had the good nuns. Now we're going to get the one the Pope doesn't want to talk about. I'm curious, how many people, not to embarrass anybody, but just I'd like to know, how many people here within their first year of abstinence? Oh, wow, whoa, welcome. How many people in their first 30 days? Oh, wow, glad you're here. Cool. You just came into an AA meeting on steroids. That's what this weekend is. It's a anybody in their last 30 days? Sometimes you catch one on the way out. I'm very delighted to be asked to talk about the first section of the inventory. The resentment section, it is probably the thing that has turned my life around the most. Of course, you know, if you would ask me to talk on 9 or 12, I would have probably said the same thing about them too. But really, this is where I got my change in perception. And my sponsor often talks about alcoholism being a disease of perception. That I seem that my ego has seemed to lock me into, and so consequently nothing changes in my life. I came into AA back in the in 1978 in Las Vegas, Nevada, and through no fault of anyone, it's just that AA at that time in that city was very oriented around the 12x12, which is a great book. And I've gotten a lot out of that book over the years. But there was no one that I found, anyway, that knew anything about even where the steps were kind of in the big book. They would send guys like me that were interested in working the steps to 12x12 study groups, and I would get a lot of identification there, and it was very cool. And consequently, I did my first fourth step in what I gleaned from meetings. And what I gleaned from meetings is that it was like a confession of all the things I was, secrets and things I was ashamed of. Okay, so I did my first fourth step. It was like 40 pages of how, I should have entitled it, "This is how bad Bob is." I mean, that would have been the good title for it. And outside of sharing a few secrets, you know, the sleazy stuff you don't want anybody to know about, outside of that, nothing really had changed. I didn't get a change in perception. I didn't look at life and people differently. I was still prone to depression and lots of anxiety, which is, don't get me wrong, it's part of the human condition, but I had it in capital letters. And I was still prone to it in capital letters. I did a second inventory, and I used the 12x12, and there's 30-some questions in there, plus the 7 deadly sins in the chapter 4, and 12, I keep saying 12x12. You don't know what that is. 12 12 and 12. And that was, it was good. It was, there was some insightful, little more insight into how bad Bob was. And then out of in a desperate move to stay here, and I think sometimes some of us has, not maybe not everybody, but some of us have to work, do what it says in the book, just to stay in the meetings, to stay in AA, to stay useful. Because I got this keeps trying to move me out of AA, and I, in a desperate, frantic, last-ditch effort, I suppose, I went back through the steps again, and by this time I had. I'd been to a Joe and Charlie seminar, and actually, this is so crazy, I had actually helped a sponsee do a fourth step out of the big book, and I hadn't done one. And I'll tell you something, in help, because I love this guy, and in trying to help him do it out of the book, it became clearer to me than it would have if I was trying to figure it out how I was going to do it. The Hindus have a saying that the student doesn't learn the lesson until it becomes a teacher. And it's funny, when I'm looking in here for you, it's clearer than when I'm looking in here for me. Isn't that a weird deal for me? Now, maybe not everybody's like that, but that was my experience. And so I sat down and I started writing this inventory. And I really had a very clear picture of what to do. And on the bottom of page 63, it's the section that's right after the third step prayer. It talks about next. Next, we launched out on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning. Well, next for me is like 3 years, three and a half, right? But I got that. I've always had that reverse dog years thing going on. I don't know what that's about. I don't. Timelines for normal people don't affect guys like me, right? So. It says, though our, this is in this line here, though our decision, step three, was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in us that were blocking us, that had been blocking us. Blocking me from what? Blocking me from... what it promises on page 55 of the big book, this power that I will find deep down within me. And if you, and in my experience is not that different. I've talked to a lot of guys. Prior to working the steps, if you sit and try to go inside yourself and find God, you don't find God. You find crazy people. I mean, you find chatter that'll drive you nuts. You'll be running to turn the TV on in about 30 seconds to distract you from this that's just going crazy. I was blocked from the God. There was no conscious contact. Now, there was faith. God's hand had been evidenced in my life. I had a lot of faith. But there's a big difference between faith in God and conscious contact. Sunday afternoon, you're all going to get in your cars and you're going to leave here. And you'll leave, drive down the street with absolute faith and assurance that there's police out there. You better drive cool. You get one in your rearview mirror with his lights on, you got conscious contact. And there's a big difference between knowing God's there and having conscious contact. And I didn't have conscious contact. I was blocked from God. Also, I was blocked from carrying out the decision in step three. I was the guy that would go to discussion meetings, and I would always share this. I'd say, well, I don't know what's wrong with me, but I turn it over, and I take it back. And I turn it over, and I haven't turned it over. I can't turn it over. Matter of fact, earlier in the chapter, it says you can't surrender because you can't wish this thing that's blocking you, this self-centeredness, away any more than alcohol. And what I was attempting to do unconsciously, I want you to understand, I'm not cognizant of this at the time. I don't get it. But here's what's really going on. I am attempting, in a desperate move, because I have a screwed up life, I'm attempting to give God my life. But unbeknownst to me, I've retained my will, which is my opinion and judgment of my life. Now, I don't know that. But if you coming from that place, and here's, it's like saying, God, here's my life, and here's a list of how it ought to go. Right? And then what happens? Well, I'm full of the anxiety that God may not do my will, and I'm still consumed and worried with me, and I get depressed periodically, which is when God stops doing my will. And I'm blocked from carrying out the decision because I have not dismantled the judgment machine, which is my ego or my will or myself or the self, in step four. So consequently, I'm a guy who's in still trying to, I'm trying to relinquish my life, but I know how I still have an opinion on how it should go. And the opinion and the judgment is what's making me nuts. Because I still have a way. I still have a way. And I was also blocked from other people. Untreated alcoholism, sober especially, I think, is a lonely business. I didn't really have any, I wasn't very close to anybody. I was in the beginning of my sobriety, and then through unbeknownst to me, through ego and self-will, I started going like this with people. Because I'm right a lot. Right? People that are right a lot are very lonely people. And I don't even know I'm doing that. And I'm very serious. I had someone at the TIE Club in Vegas, an AA Club in Vegas, accuse me of having my sense of humor surgically removed. I mean, I was like... Everything's big deal. Everything. I'm self-righteous. You know the problem with self-righteous? Self. So I'm in a bad spot. I'm blocked not only from God and from carrying out the decision in step three. I'm blocked from other people. I'm a lonely guy that's right a lot. And it says our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions. Therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. This was step four. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Do you ever, alcoholism sometimes feels like you're going down the drain and you're hoping against hope to stop it. It usually goes broke. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and a fact-facing process. It's an effort to discover the truth about stock and trade. My first two inventories, I did not face any facts about me that I didn't know. I mean, I was there. I did all that sleazy stuff. I did all that bad stuff. There was no new information. I did not discover any truth about me. I didn't. I mean, I just didn't. I did when I did this. Changed my perception. So what do we say? Well, it says it compares it to this thing, and we do exactly the same thing with our lives as a commercial inventory. And then it starts into the first section. And it says resentment is the number one offender. Isn't it? When I was brand new, you couldn't have sold me on that. I would have thought it was guilt or remorse or shame. But that stuff has its way. That seems to be self-resolving a lot of that in time, where resentments are forever. I had cases built against my parents and my grade school teachers that were still files that I had them stashed away. But you mention their name, oh, I'll bring the file out and I'll start explaining it to you. Right? Resentment's a funny thing. The ego demands to be right, so it locks in a picture of someone. 30 years later, they could have changed. No, they haven't changed. Which is crazy, because that would mean that you don't change either, right? People change, but the ego doesn't want to acknowledge that. It wants to be right in this judgment about you. And it changes your perception. Do you ever notice when you have a resentment towards someone? It alters your ability to perceive them. From the moment you get the resentment, did you ever notice they can't do anything right? Did you ever notice that? Matter of fact, you just got this zoom lens on your perception that zooms in on anything that possibly they could be out of line. So the voice in your head can go, eh, see. See. And then the book later talks about we turn this thing on ourselves and we're sore at ourselves and then we remorse and eventually depression. And depression is just as perception altering. It's like you took some kind of mind-altering drug with resentments or with depression. Do you ever notice when you're depressed, it looks like you've always been that way? You always will be that way. If somebody says something positive to you about you, they're stupid. Right? Oh, this is going to be good for you. It's going to turn around. I had my sponsor one time. I called him up, and I was used to battle with depression, my early sobriety, and I called him up, and I was really in a bad spot. And I said, I don't just get depressed. My body gets depressed. My voice gets depressed. I mean, everything gets depressed. I think my hair gets depressed. Everything gets depressed. And I said, oh, Dick, I just feel awful. He says, well, how long have you felt like this? I've always felt like this. He said you were laughing and carrying on Friday night at the home group. You know what I said? And I meant it. I said, I must have been in denial. But it looks that way. It looks like it's a long tunnel, great tunnel into infinity. Right? Always. Was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be. World without end. Oh, man. It just changes my perception. So what the answer is, I have to change my perception back to reality. The book says discover the truth. Fact-finding, fact-facing. Resentment's the number one offender. Resentment comes from a Latin resentire, meaning to resensitize, refeel, replay. I'm good at that. But I don't replay events where I'm hurt with a normal perception. My ego is in charge of the video booth, right? And it zooms the camera in on what you did, kind of shades out maybe anything I did to contribute to the situation, because that's not important. What's important is what you did, right? And I got this little narrator that's Howard Cosell-like in my head that says things to me, and after all you've done for them, Bob, you know what I mean, right? You know that little voice, you know? Yeah. So it destroys more alcoholics than anything else. That's a pretty powerful line. It may very well mean that it destroys more alcoholics than even alcohol. I think alcohol is the caboose. I think alcoholism is the engine that runs you over. By the time most of us drink again, we're so sick that we need to drink again, right? You just don't go from happy, joyous, and free to let me destroy myself like that. It's a very slow process. From it stem all forms of spiritual disease. Every time in my whole life I've ever had a resentment, if I were to stop and get quiet, what would happen, what would be real for me is that my very spirit, my very being would feel ill. It feels ill when you're in a resentment. It's not free. It's locked up. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. Boy, there's a lot of hope in that line for a guy like me. And I think that that's very true. I noticed is the other side of the fourth step, I experienced something that I don't know that I've ever experienced sober before. And it kind of scared me. It was peace. I didn't know what it was. I thought something was wrong. Because all the dialogues are kind of going like this. You know, I saw a movie one time where this guy who lived under the L train in the, I think it was in Brooklyn or the Bronx or somewhere in New York, was out camping. And he freaks out in the middle of the night, and the guy with him says, "What's wrong?" He says, "Don't you hear that?" He says, "I don't hear anything." He says, "Yeah, I know." And I had a little experience with that right after the fifth step. It felt like something was wrong because I'm used to it. Talks about this in the 12-way time. It says, we're used to our three emotional conditions: anxiety, excitement, and depression. Peace is like, what's that? It feels like boredom to some of us. So what do we do? It says, in dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. We listed the people, the institutions, or principals with whom we are angry. I tell the guys I sponsor, I said, allow yourself to be petty because you are anyway. Just put it all down. Don't let your head, because I'm a minimizer. I minimize stuff. My head will go, well, I haven't seen them for 5 years. I tell the guys I sponsor sometimes, anybody that you'd have a hard time spending time with, or anybody that if their name comes up, you start having a conversation with them in your head, put them down. I think guys probably more than gals, because we grew up with the John Wayne macho, nothing hurts me kind of deal. We sometimes have a harder time acknowledging or resentments. There's something in me that doesn't want to admit to, even to myself, that anyone could hurt me, like as if I'm bulletproof or something. And about 8 years ago, I had a guy come to me wanted me. He was sober 23 years, and he'd never worked this. Well, I think in early sobriety, he did a little brief how bad I am inventory, but he hadn't really worked the steps. And he's 23 years sober, and he's nuts. He's insane. Here's how crazy he is. He's planning on killing himself, which is perfectly okay for him. The problem is now the obsession to drink, since he's going to die anyway, has returned, and he's afraid he's going to drink before he pulls the plug on himself, right? And he doesn't mind that he's going to die. He just doesn't want, after he's dead, people to talk about him, that he'd lost his sobriety, right? Now, some of you that have egos like mine get that. Oh, yeah, I don't mind dying. I just don't want to look bad, you know? Right. So we start working the steps, and we did the third step prayer, and I told him, I said, I want you to make a list of all your resentments. And this is an uptight guy, right? And he looks at me, he's got his arms like this. Resentments. I don't have any resentments. Wow. I said, really? He said, no, I'm not, just let it all go. It doesn't bother me. Well, this guy's, you can tell by his body language, he's angst about a lot of stuff. So what I said to him next was kind of inspired, I guess, because I don't know where it came from. I'd never said this to anybody before. I said to him, I said, Jerry, I said, let's do something different. Let's make a list of people you feel smugly superior to. And he got this look on his face like, oh my God, will that be a long list? And aren't we really making a list of our judgments? Really? I think the inventory is putting out in the open the manifestations of my ego, all my the thing that judges, that plays God. What's it say in step 3? First of all, we had to quit playing God. Well, how do you do that if that's all you've done all your life? That's like telling an NFL football team, we're going out in the field today, but we're playing basketball. Well, they played football. That's going to be very difficult for them. When you play God all the time and judged people and been right, and then when they don't do your will, they get the wrath of Bob, you know. And so it's not an easy deal. So we listed, and I went back through my life, and I had a lot of resentments. And then next to each name, there's a column 2 on page 65. It says we ask ourselves why. Why were we angry? And then if you'll notice in column 2, it's bullet points. It's very brief stuff, bullet points, you know, just quick. And it gives, you know, a couple reasons for some resentments. And there's usually, I don't think I've ever seen one that had more than four points, I think. Maybe five. I don't even think I've seen five. Maybe, I don't know. But usually just a couple points. It's in what they did. Almost as if you're like a prosecuting attorney creating your case. Okay, you got the perpetrator of the evil deed. You got what they did that hurt you. And then finally, the third column, it uses five words to talk about the third column. It uses the word hurt, threatened, affected, injured, or interfered with. And what is it? What manifestation of self? And this is where, you know, earlier in the book it says we found that selfishness, self-centeredness was the root of our problems. And then going into the inventory, it says we're going to look for the manifestations of self, which had defeated us. And we're looking for, and here's how you know it's self, because we're looking for where was my self-esteem, my pocketbook, my ambitions, my personal relationships, my security, my sex relations that had been hurt, threatened, injured, affected, or interfered with, and we list them all on paper. Now, this is a pretty good case we got against these guys. Isn't it funny that aren't we really, I mean, if objectively, aren't you really making a list of the people who really owe you an amends? Well, we will see. I got to tell you something. If you can't stand to be wrong, oh, this is going to be tough on you. I'm telling you. You're going to be tough on you. Prior to doing this, my first two inventories, I would have, if you asked me what's the exact nature of your wrongs, I'd have told you about the guy I stabbed. I'd have told you about the money I stole. But there's something underneath all of that, the exact nature. Where was I wrong? Where was my perception screwed up and that I was so driven to do these things? Where was I wrong? And the bottom of the page says, we went back through our lives, nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. When we were finished, we considered it carefully. The first thing apparent was that this world and its people were often quite wrong. To conclude that others were wrong was as far as most of us ever got. The usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us. We stayed sore. Sometimes it was remorse, and then we were sore at ourselves. But the more we fought, tried to have our own way, the worse matters got. As in war, the victor only seemed to win. Our moments of triumph were short-lived. It is plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. The book spends the next two paragraphs hammering in the deadliness of resentments. They're infinitely grave. They're poison. They shut us off from the sunlight of the Spirit. We die. They're fatal. I mean, it's very hammering. It just, and do I get that? Yeah, I think so. When you're full of resentments, you feel like you're dying anyway. You know, really. And then it comes, the second line in the last full paragraph brings me to a point that is, I think, is important. It comes from an assumption that I think if it's not true, it's going to be hard to go on to do the real work that's coming up. And it says, we were prepared to look at these from an entirely different angle. Am I? Am I willing to possibly be wrong about these people? Am I willing to look at it from an entirely different angle. And to do that, what would that be? Well, how have I been looking at it so far? I've been looking at it from a prosecuting attorney's point of view. I got my case built against these guys. So an entirely different angle would be to walk across the courtroom and sit on the bench for the defense and now start looking at it and talking about it from their point of view. Whoa. It looks a little different over there. What's the story that the guy I'm angry at is telling his best friend or confidant about what happened between me and him? I bet you it's different than my story. I bet you. There's a line here that I had an experience that this line touches on. It says that in this state, the wrongdoings of others fancied or real had the power to actually kill. When I was fairly new in sobriety, there was a guy named Billy Taylor, and Billy was a good guy. He was an old timer. He used to take guys like me out to coffee. I got a lot of my AA in coffee shops with old timers after meetings. They just spoon feed it to me. And one night in a coffee shop with this guy Billy, I ended up telling him some things about myself that were very, very secretive, things I was the most ashamed of. You know the things I'm talking about, right? Everybody's different stuff. Some of you, maybe you got drunk and you beat your kids. Maybe you did it when you were hungover. Maybe the fear in their eyes, you can't get that picture out of your mind as they sat there and cowered and shook. Maybe you did like I did, and when your dog that loved you unconditionally came up to lick your face on a day that you really hated yourself, you just kicked and hit that dog because you hated anything that would dare love someone that you hated the most. And maybe the dog still cowers around you. Maybe it changed everything. Maybe you dimed out somebody and they went to prison because you wanted to save your own butt. And you just feel, and you hate yourself for that. Or maybe you did something to your mother and father who just, it broke their heart. Or maybe you recurringly broke their heart to the point where they're not even in your life anymore. Maybe you broke the heart of people, everyone who dared love you. Maybe you had sex with someone you wouldn't even want to be seen having lunch with. Maybe you had sex outside your species. I don't know. I don't know what you did. I don't know what you did. I just know you did something. I don't know what you did. I mean, we all come here with that shame. We all come here with a feeling that there's something really wrong with me, and we all come here with secrets. That old saying in AA, we're as sick as our secrets. And I told Billy my stuff, and he took it. He seemed to take it okay. I got to tell you something. It would have helped if he would have said me too. He didn't say that. That would have. If he would have said, "Oh yeah, I did that." No, you know what he said? He said. And it was okay, I guess. He said, "Well, I'm sure you're not the only one that ever did that, and maybe someday that experience will help someone." But I remember in the back of my mind thinking, that sounds like a little bit like the AA party line. But it was okay. And I went home that night, because he didn't reject me, so I didn't, you know. And I had my shift changed at work, and I went for a good part of a year where I was going to completely different meetings, and I didn't see him. And then one night on my night off, I went to a meeting that I normally didn't go to, and Billy was there, and I was delighted to see him. You know the way you are, people, when you're new, that you were important to you, and I saw him, and I said, "Hey, Billy, how you doing?" And he looked at me with this look that it looked like disgust, looked like pain, a pained look, a look that kind of said, "Ugh, get over it." And then he turned, he couldn't even look me in the eye, turned away, and went and sat down. Now, the meeting starts and I'm messed up, right? Because I'm hurt because I know what's going on here. I know that he's been judging me for the stuff. And there's a part of me can't blame him. God knows I've judged myself harshly enough for that. And I've always secretly believed that if you knew about me what I knew about me, you'd feel about me the way I feel about me. And that's not good. And I'm sitting there, and I don't just get hurt, though. I get angry. It's an automatic thing with me. When I'm hurt, I get angry. Automatic. It's a defense mechanism. And so I'm getting angry, and I'm saying, what a hypocrite. I'm getting hot. And then in the middle of the anger, I had this like epiphany-like experience where I thought, wait a minute. Oh, my God, the reason he can't even look me in the eye, he's been telling everybody that stuff. It became so clear to me. There was a girl I had just, down to TIE Club, I had just asked her out, and she would not go out with me, and she's friends with him. I knew. There was another guy he runs around with. He's been a little distant. Man, now I'm insane. I'm enraged. Now I'm gonna beat him up, right? And I'm just cocked and ready. As soon as the meeting's over, I'm going to go tear into this guy, and he's going to deserve everything he gets. Well, the chairman's ready to close the meeting. The chairman says, anybody have a burning desire? And Billy raises his hand. Tells everybody in the room that the biopsy came back and the tumor's malignant. And it's an advanced type of bad cancer, and he has a very short time to live. And I sat there, and I felt about this big as I realized that saying hi to Bob on the day he found out he was dying was probably not a big priority. That I realized that he was probably so afraid and up in his head, as I would be, scared that he didn't, consumed that he didn't even know I was there. That the pained look on his face didn't have anything to do with me. It was like a little postcard from God. Dear Bob, you don't know crap. Love God. Well, the reason I'm telling you this story is when a couple years later, I'm doing a fourth step, and it says we're prepared to look at this from an entirely different angle. See, I knew something. I knew that I can be wrong. And if I could be that wrong about Billy, could I be that wrong about my mother and father? Could my perception of them be wrong? Could the story I've been telling myself in my head be fancied to some degree? Could it? Sandy has a wonderful saying. He says, the longer he's sober, the nicer his childhood gets. Man, I'm telling you. That's really true. And it's not that we're deluding ourselves now. We're seeing reality now. We deluded ourselves before. So the book spends this whole page just about telling me I got to get free of this stuff. It's going to kill me. And then after it hammers it, oh, it's going to kill you, it's going to kill you, it's going to kill you. Then it says, oh, by the way, you can't wish these away any more than alcohol. Why do they tell you they got to, oh, God. Once again, I am stuck in a trap I cannot spring. So what do I do? Well, it's going to ask me to approach this thing from the flank, to do something that would have never occurred to me. I'm too self-centered. It's asking me to realize something. It says we realize that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Yeah, I get that. They're idiots too. Yeah. Well, but it goes on to say, and this is the line that turned me around. And this created such a change in me that I have never been the same since. It says, though we did not like their symptoms, column two, what they did to me that incurred the hurt. And one of the great things about, the few great things about just the first three columns is it separates the person from the deed. It's not Joe I hate. It's the fact he slept with my girlfriend, right? Though I did not like their symptoms, column number two, that they, and this is what kicked me, that and the way they disturbed us, that they, like ourselves, were sick too. That they're like me, sick too. This is not a well person looking down with pity on a sick person. No, sir. This is a sick person looking at a sick person. This is one guy in a cancer ward suffering from occasional weird symptoms from chemo looking at another guy who occasionally is suffering from maybe sometimes slightly different symptoms from the chemo, but they're all, my God, that's me. He's going through what I'm going through. Maybe my spiritual illness made me rob you. And maybe yours made you hit them. but we're driven. Earlier in the book, it says we're driven. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. It ain't my fault. It is my responsibility, but it ain't my fault. And so I started to see how these people, I started to awaken. And I think, you know, we talk a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous about awakening. Matter of fact, it's the great promise in the 12th step. And I think a lot of the awakening is I awaken to the truth. I awaken to the me that is in you. This is where I started to get restored to a sense of community. As I started to go through my whole life and all my judgments and see how bogus they were, how self-serving and egotistical they were, how I deluded myself and told myself stories about you, and the stories started to vanish as I saw myself in you. And I started to realize, my God, if I'd been raised like you were raised, if I'd been hurt like you had been hurt, if I was afraid like you were afraid, my God, I could have easily done the same thing to someone else that you'd done to me. And then all of a sudden, all the wind out of my puffed up balloon seems to deflate because I'm not smugly superior. The guy I'm angry at is me. My God, that's me. Maybe it's me on a really bad day, but it's me. And one of the things that came out of this sense of community is I really got it that anything that any human being has ever done to another human being, I'm capable of. If I haven't done it, maybe I hadn't been hurt in the exact same way that you were hurt or abused the exact same way you were abused. Or maybe I didn't have the exact same combination of alcohol and drugs and anger and frustration and loneliness and lust or whatever the deal is that's driving you. Maybe I didn't have the exact same combinations to spin it out and push me the way it pushed you. But can I get that it is all in me and could have? If there's something I didn't do, it's not by virtue, it's by circumstance. See, the ego wants to say it's by virtue. You know, did you ever notice when you look at somebody that's done something out of line, you go, well, I would have never done that. Kind of puff up, you know? I'd have never done that. Yes, I would. If I was in their shoes, I could have done that. What a tremendous awakening this had been. I got about a couple minutes. I'll tell you one story. I got a couple of them, but I'll tell you this one. People seem to connect with this. Many, many years ago, 18, 19, 20 years ago, I was listening to a guy's fifth step, and in the middle of about a third of the way, actually, through the resentment section, he'd buried the worst resentment of all for him, the one that had eaten his lunch for years, decades. And it was towards his father. And his father was a bad drunk, and his father was very rageful and violent. And his dad used to get drunk and beat this poor kid. I mean, just he ended up in the emergency room in the hospital a couple times. And because he was so ashamed, he had to make up stories about how he fell off his bike or he fell out of a tree or, you know, all that stuff, right? And his dad used to scream and yell. And then when his dad was sober, sometimes his dad would be forced into these brief periods of abstinence because he'd get in so much trouble. And that was just as bad because he was so restless, irritable, and discontent that he'd yell and scream and shut up and get to your room and you're stupid. And these resentments ate him alive for years. He'd spent 8 years in therapy with a Gestalt therapist, beating pillows and doing the Gestalt chair thing with his dad and all that stuff, and nothing really changed. Nothing really changed. And we're getting into this, and we get into the part where this was our course, and I read it to him, and he's looking at me like I'm from Pluto. And I pulled out the 12x12, and there's a paragraph in there that I think is beautiful. It's in step 10, but it's the same principle. and I'm, this is not a direct quote, it's a, I'm going to try to hit it. It's, Bill said something like, as we approach true tolerance and see what real love actually means, it will become more and more apparent that other people like ourselves are frequently wrong, as well as emotionally ill. And as we approach true tolerance and love, we'll see that all people, including ourselves, are suffering from the pains of growing up. In other words, can you get it? Can you see yourself in these people? And he couldn't. And I said, I was pointed with him. I said, you got to realize how you're, I read, this was our course, you got to realize how you're like your father. And he flipped out on me. He started yelling at me. I ain't like my father, my father. He went on this venomous, just dumping of emotion that was very frightening. If you've ever been around someone like that, just explodes with stuff that's been in them for a long time, man, it is, it's like, wow. And I just, I don't know what to do. It's scaring me. I just back up a little bit. And I just think to myself, well, guess he's not prepared to look at this from an entirely different angle. And I don't know what to do. I love this guy. I don't know what to do, man. I'm at the end of my rope, and something happened to me. I said to him, just go ahead. Go ahead. And he starts reading the next resentment. And what something happened to me that was not of me, but through me. And I think it happened because at the beginning of listening to a fifth step, I ask God, I get quiet and I ask God to help me be useful, make me useful. And Bob has a great saying, and he says, we never are the well, but sometimes we get to be the pipe. And what happened next was down the pipe. And I stopped him, and because something was stuck in my craw, I stopped him. I said, I want to go back to another resentment. I want to go back. And he says, you got to get defensive. We want to talk more about my dad. No. Back to the very near the beginning. At the beginning there was a woman that you had a resentment because she rejected, dumped you or something. You lived with her for a number of years. There were kids and stuff. He said, yeah, what of it? And I said to him, I said, I was just wondering if any time in that relationship you might have done anything when you were drunk or on drugs or hungover to hurt those kids. And it was like the color started running out of him. And he put his head down. And I don't know what's going on with this guy. And he lifts his head up. He has a tear running down one side of his face. And he says, I remember the voice. He says, I'm just like my goddamn father. And I said to him, I said, how'd you feel about yourself when you hurt those kids? He shook his head. He says, I couldn't stay drunk enough. I said, do you think you're any different than your dad? And he took a moment and he said to me, he said, you know, I haven't seen my dad in years, but my dad's never really been able to get sober. My sister's the only one that sees him anymore. And she says that he lives alone in the middle of nowhere in California in some little town in this trailer, at this trailer park, little dumpy joint, depressed. He's got such liver and pancreas problems that his body will not metabolize alcohol, and he's been forced physically into a state of abstinence, and his sister told him that he was the most miserable person she'd ever known. And then he said to me, after I asked, we talked a little more, and he said, at one point, he said, maybe that my father is a vision of my future without Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was starting for the first time to see through the veil of the ego to see the truth. This is not that his father wasn't wrong. His father was very sick and very wrong. The freedom comes from getting the truth. It's seeing yourself in the person you resent. There's a word that's battered around a lot. I think most people don't know what it means. It's called the words compassion. It comes from two Latin words, cum, meaning with, and passio, meaning pain. You have compassion, means you can sit with their pain. You get it. You've connected the dots. You found yourself in them. And he was able to do that. And lastly, we went to there's a prayer there. It says we ask God to help us to show them. That's a demonstration. Show them. Act towards them. The same patience, pity, and tolerance we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. Everyone on your resentment list, if they hadn't have done what was in column 2 because they were sick, they would still be your friend. You'd be cheerful to them. If the sickness had been removed that drove them to do column two, and it's a call for action to demonstrate towards them, to show them. And then in the last part it says, referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we resolutely look for our own mistakes. And a little further on it says, we try to disregard the other person involved entirely. Well, if I used to say, tell my guys, I say, we're going to look for our part here. The book doesn't say that. And that terminology is used so often in AA, which is, it's not nothing wrong with the terminology, but sometimes in some of us, not everybody, but it can have an implication. And the implication is, if I'm going to look for my part, the implication, there's another part. Now, whose part do you think I would think is bigger? Not mine. No, the book says we look for our mistakes. And he started doing that. He started looking at his father, not in the light of the terrible, sick things his dad did, but he started looking at what kind of a son he was. What if you can't hide the selfishness and the vindictiveness and the vengefulness and the self-righteousness and all the manifestations of self? What if you don't hide them in the shadow of what they did was wrong? What if you had to look at that person as if he was God's child and perfect? You have the perfect father. Now, what kind of son was I? Ooh. Oh. The ego goes, yeah, but he wasn't a perfect father. He was, What if you disregard the other person involved entirely? What kind of a son were you? And he realized he was a terrible son. He'd used his father's sickness as an excuse to borrow thousands and thousands of dollars for his dad. He never paid back a dime because his dad is... He gossiped about his father and pumped himself up in self-righteousness and turned almost the whole family and friends against his dad. There was only one person left that had everything to do with his father, and that was his sister. And when he really got it, he felt ashamed of himself. He thought, oh my God, my poor father, that's me. And then he knew in himself that he'd hurt people and they'd done the same thing to him. They had turned on him. There had been people that had hurt him and used his sickness to justify it. And he was able to go make amends to his father. And he knocked on the, he told me, I said, call, we talked before he got there, and before he went to the door, and he said, this trailer, and I said, call me when you're done. He called me, and I said, what happened? He said, I was scared. He's afraid of the monster of his childhood. He's scared inside, shaken. And he said, what opened the door was not this monster, it was this little old, shaking, scared man. And he, one point he told me when he, there was a point where he looked in his dad's eyes and he saw himself. And he loved on his father until his father died. He used the money that he'd borrowed from his father to take care of his father. He'll tell you to this day, many years later, that the greatest thing Alcoholics Anonymous had given him next to his sobriety, he got his daddy back. Restoration. Alcoholics Anonymous really will provide a 180-degree turn in perception. Thank you for listening.